Hi, this is Nancy Clare, and welcome to episode 50 of Speaking of Mysteries. Before I introduce this week's guest, I'd like to give a shout out to my pal Jeff Pierce at The Rap Sheet for including a link to Speaking of Mysteries interview with Tom Nolan as part of his very comprehensive Q&A with Tom. I'm honored beyond words. This week's guest is Scottish crime fiction writer Christopher Brookmeyer, whose Dead Girl Walking, the next installment in his series featuring disgraced journalist turned investigator Jack Parlavane, is being released today, May 5th, 2015. Chris and I talked about his Parlavane series and the Jasmine Sharp, Catherine McLeod series, along with a number of other subjects, including the late Canadian novelist Robertson Davies' influence on him. Here's Christopher Brookmeyer. Welcome back to Speaking of Mysteries. This is Nancy Clare, and I am really thrilled that today's guest is Christopher Brookmeyer, who's joining us from Scotland.
Hello.
Let's talk a little bit about the book that is just about to be released in the United States, Dead Girl Walking. Jack Parlavane, the character, the central character, has had a career that can be described as up and down, maybe mostly down. I read that he was inspired by Ford Perfect from The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, but named for a character from Robertson Davies. And we'll talk a little bit more about Robertson Davies. What was it about Ford Perfect that inspired you to build a character around him?
Well, I'd say it was a degree of inspiration. And first of all, at the risk of sounding impolite, I have to correct you. It's not Ford Perfect. It's Ford Prefect.
Oh.
And he's named after a car. It was a. I don't think there was a Ford Prefect in the US. It was a British model. And that was the joke, was that he was trying to come up with what sounded like an authentic name when he arrived on Earth and chose Ford Prefect, not realising it was the name of a car.
I'm embarrassed.
But I, at the time of writing Quite Ugly One Morning, I wanted to write a satire about what was going on in health reforms in the UK, and I wanted to write a kind of pacey crime story, and I didn't want to make the hero a police officer because, one, I didn't know an awful lot about police procedure, and two, I thought there was just plenty of police officer characters already in British crime fiction, and I knew a lot more about journalism, but I wanted it to be a kind of satirical and scurrilous book with a character that suited that. And I came up with the idea of Jack Parlavane and probably realised after the fact that Ford Prefect had been kind of the template, because what I loved about Ford Prefect was that he was so blithe in going into situations that he seemed to be almost oblivious of how much danger he was in. And I didn't want to make Parlavane quite as blind as that, but I did want it to be kind of amusing that someone who quite liked the thrill of breaking into places, or quite liked the frisson of the forbidden about finding out information.
Well, you gave him this unique skill set too, which is really interesting. I mean, he comes to his tasks, and of course, he's been a mountain climber and a rock climber, and many of these, especially when it comes to breaking and entering, really work for him. But in Dead Girl Walking, he's committed to no longer doing the things that he's done in the previous books. He's turned a leaf.
Well, I think it was in one of the previous books, or in several of the previous books, there's this gradual evolution away from that, largely because of his wife's disapproval of it. And in one of the novels, he ends up in jail because he does get caught breaking into somewhere, although he's actually he's walked into a trap on that occasion. And with those books, they were far less down to earth. They were very, very outrageous. And he, as a character in those earlier books, was probably less believable and less human because he had all these slightly over the top skills. And when I wrote Dead Girl Walking, I wanted it to be more human. I wanted him to be humbled and be at a low ebb. But the excitement for me was that to make the book seem more realistic and have him seem more vulnerable, and yet by the end of the story he has done all the things that he's done in previous books, and that for me it was more exciting to have him do those things having been laid so low, because it's kind of the beginnings of him putting himself back together again, because he's been completely eviscerated by the start of the story. And the humorous thing is, I gave him this skill set, as you described it, in an attempt to make him far larger than life and slightly outrageous and more interesting to the reader, thinking that these were outrageous things for a journalist to be doing. But what's happened in recent times is we've discovered that breaking into computers and phones and raiding people's files is actually standard practice in British journalism.
Jack Parlabane, explorer in the vanguard.
Pioneer, yeah, of disreputable practice.
What I found from Dead Girl Walking was the view from the inside of the music profession through Monica's journal just seems spot on. And I was wondering, was there a particular inspiration for that approach, and also the switching from first person of the journal to third person for the other parts of the book?
I think that the change in emphasis was that I wanted there to be something more immediate from the view inside the band, especially when it's from the point of view of someone who's comparatively new to the whole world of rock and roll. So I thought it would make it more personal and it would really draw the reader in, that Monica's passages should be from the first person. But in terms of writing about being in a band, I've always been a big music fan, but in recent years I'd on occasion met a few musicians or been corresponding with musicians and sitting. There was, in fact, one occasion, the new Frightened Rabbit album came out at the same week as one of my novels. So there was a music website got Scott Hutchison of Frightened Rabbit and myself to interview each other in a rehearsal space in Glasgow. And so talking to Scott on and off over the last couple of years and talking to other musicians, I kind of got, over the years, I got an impression of the reality of what it was to be on tour and the different stages of musicians' careers as well. The fact that when you're young and having a bit of success, you think it's always going to be success. And the more experienced the musician, the more they learn to value the good times and the success when it comes along. So another musician that I've talked to quite a bit over the years was Greg Dooley of the Afghan Whigs, who I remember him telling me the sort of less glamorous side of being on a tour bus. You know, that people think it's all you're going to be sex, drugs, and alcohol. And he was talking about things like how there's a race to get to sleep because you want to be asleep before the guys who snore start snoring, you know. And these are the pragmatic realities of being in a band on tour. You're going to start getting on each other's nerves. There's going to be petty jealousies are going to start to build up. And that to me was far more fascinating than the glamorous and cliched version about sex, drugs and televisions getting chucked out of hotel room windows.
Although there was a fair amount of sex and some drugs.
And drugs, yeah.
No TVs were harmed in the writing of your book, however. I have to ask, though, the Savage Earth Heart, did you get that name from the Waterboys song?
Yeah.
And aside from the fact that the Waterboys are not fronted by a female vocalist, as soon as I saw the name of the band, that's the music I started to hear. And now I can't get the whole of the moon out of my head.
Well, there was an earlier draft of the book where I talked about how Heike, when she's around her father, when he's painting in his studio, that he would listen to the Waterboys, and that was where she got the idea to call the band Savage Earth Heart. And that's why... also that there was that she was inspired by certain types of sound that the Waterboys had produced, but my editor was conscious that there's a decreasing number of people now who remember the Waterboys. He did a straw poll. He went round the office at the publishers and couldn't find anyone who'd heard of them, which seems quite horrifying to those of us who grew up and knew they were, you know, a massive band that, you know, hugely influential in their time.
And they're still performing. I mean, yes,
yeah,
you're
yeah.
absolutely right. I mean, wasn't the Waterboys started, I think, in the 80s?
Yeah, I think the album that the track Savage Earth Heart is on, I think, was about 1980 or 81. And so... Whole of the Moon was 85.
Boy, that seems like yesterday to me, and I am aging myself. So the publisher must have very, very young people.
That's what I'd like to tell myself. You know?
I mean, very young. So I mentioned Robertson Davies, and when I read that you had named Jack Parlebaine, although I recognized it when I started reading... I was really excited because that's sort of another icon of the 80s that seems to have fallen away. And he was a huge, I was a big fan of his and have read everything that he's ever written. And I'm sorry that he didn't live long enough for the age of Twitter, because I think he would have been fantastic. But I can think of two of your characters, Jack Parlebaine and Simon Darkhart, that are named for Davies' characters. And are there any others?
There's not other characters, but there is in The Sacred Art of Stealing, which is about an art gallery heist. There, at one point, it's mentioned that there's a painting on loan to this gallery in Glasgow, and it's on loan from a gallery in Toronto. And the painting is The Marriage Feast at Cana. And it amused me to have the idea of a fictional painting about which there was an entire novel on loan to another fictional gallery in another work of fiction. So that was my other nod, which the real Robertson Davies enthusiasts do pick up on and they do tend to appreciate.
Well, now I haven't read that, but now I have to go read it because it's like a canon to me, his books and his characters and his and the way he sets up his stories and the arcs that go through the book, which is similar to what you do and sort of anticipates my next question. You are the creator of three series that I can count, but you often let characters from one series make appearances in others. In Dead Girl Walking, Catherine MacLeod is one of the Scottish police officers who responds to some events that take place in Glasgow. Is it harder or easier to keep it all straight when the characters move about, or does it not matter at all? Am I overthinking?
Oh, it often just amuses me. If I'm thinking there's a small role to be played, then I realise that a character from a previous book can come in there, then I think it gives the readers a little buzz when they recognise a character if he's got a cameo appearance. Certainly the kind of obsessive in me likes that when I'm, whether it's books or TV movies, if there's some kind of crossover that gives me a sort of pleasant surprise. In the case of Dead Girl Walking, there's a character early on makes an appearance called Spammy, who was a major character in one novel, and they had another appearance somewhere else. But he's one of the characters that people keep asking, when am I bringing him back? But the problem was, he was a character who is a bit of a stoner, but ends up caught up in a sort of massive conspiracy thriller, and he's the type of guy who would make damn sure he never gets caught up in anything exciting ever again. You know, so it wouldn't be plausible to have another book with him as a central figure, but he's fun to pop up now and again. And the photographer that takes the band's photograph at one point in Dead Girl Walking, he was the main character in my third novel. And the book was called Not the End of the World, and I realised that I was going to have this scene where Heike and Monica are getting a photograph taken, and I think on the morning I started writing, I thought, well, why not make it this character, because he was a photographer back then and people will be wondering what happened to him. And it does seem to please the readers when they see that someone has come back. It was a book actually about Los Angeles. It was set in Los Angeles, and it was kind of about partly about my impressions of the place. And it was set in 1999, and it was my take on pre-millennial hysteria, which you know, all these, which is one of the reasons it was called Not the End of the World. The other reason it was called Not the End of the World was it was one of my favourite remarks about Los Angeles. Someone said, it's not the end of the world, but you can certainly see it from there.
I think I have to agree, and I'm sure I've heard that before. So I'm going to have to find your backlist. And that actually brings up something else. You know, Scottish writers, of which I'm mildly obsessed, and I was at the first Bloody Scotland crime writing festival.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And at the second. And had always... And I really fancied myself as someone who had read a lot of Scottish crime fiction, Denise Mina, Ian Rankin, Val McDermott, Alex Gray. And then I go to Scotland and I see that there are hundreds of unbelievably good crime fiction writers. And I asked Val McDermott this question, is there something in the water? Because you're a country of 4 million? About 4 million?
5 million, yeah.
Five million. All right, so, okay, sorry, I'm off by a million. But honestly, it's an amazing richness of crime fiction, and I'm, you know, now I discover that you've written 18 books, and I picked up my first few when I was there in 2012. And it just, why do you think it's difficult for Scottish authors to really get the readership they deserve in the United States?
I don't know. In my case, a lot of my early books were very rooted in British politics, and also they had an awful lot of extremely arcane Scottish slang and dialect, which might have been a bit of a problem. I think that the more recent novels, the Jasmine Sharp trilogy, was more universal in that respect. I mean, these were books that were fundamentally about Glasgow and were sort of selling a sense of the city. But the storylines were quite universal. They were often about family, about parenthood, and they were also less slang heavy, and they were less rooted in the more obscure elements of Scottish popular culture. So, and I think Dead Girl Walking as well, I think people wouldn't pick that up, and I'm hoping American readers aren't going to think this is something that you'd need to be a bit of a Scottophile to be interested in. I think if you're interested in music, or just interested in a sort of obsessive, suspenseful mystery story, then that would be an intriguing book to pick up. As to come back to the question, though, of why there's so many Scottish crime writers. I think it's the answer is because there are. You know, I think that the more Scottish crime writers there are, then I think the more people in Scotland who, when they have aspirations towards writing, they're more inclined to aspire towards writing crime fiction. I think if there had been in other areas, other regions, the predominant form of fiction will be the one that is most influential. And I think if people start, I mean, if you go back 25 years, there was very few Scottish crime writers. You know, there was when Ian Rankin first started writing, there was only a handful of Scottish crime writers.
Well, those sort of really McIlvany and
William McIlvany, and it was. I think that what's happened is now people read crime fiction, and in the past, they might, if they wanted to write a novel, they might have thought of a historical novel, or they might have thought of just a more literary novel. But now they'll read lots of Scottish crime fiction. I think, hey, I'd like to write that.
Well, but when you talk about the obscure settings and the like, I mean, you've got Peter May writing about the Isle of Lewis.
Yeah.
Craig Robertson went even further and wrote about the Faroes, which isn't even Scotland. I mean, it's even further afield. It seems that maybe because of the recent election, that maybe that the profile of Scottish fiction is increasing because of that, or just critical mass.
I think that obviously the eyes of the world were upon Scotland in the autumn of this year to an extent that they haven't been in quite some time. And so we can all just hope that what people have seen on the news about it would make them that bit more interested. But it's always hard to tell. I think if a director made a successful mainstream movie that was based on a Scottish crime novel, that would do more internationally than any real world event to sell Scottish crime fiction abroad.
Or actually, more what they're doing these days, like Bosch on Netflix, the adaptation on many of these streaming outlets, Amazon, Netflix, HBO, and Showtime, I think mysteries and mystery series probably lend themselves better. I thought they did a remarkably good job with Bosch, especially since...
I would agree.
Pardon me?
I would agree.
And, you know, I think that Scotland makes an excellent location, and you'd probably get a lot of people going over there, if only for the whiskey.
Yeah.
By the time you were 30, you had three novels published. Did you set out to be a novelist after university? You mentioned you'd been a journalist with a cinema magazine. And were you always interested in crime fiction? And I guess I should throw in, who influenced you?
I was someone who always wanted to be a writer from early childhood. As soon as I could write paragraphs, sentences, I was writing stories. But with regards to crime fiction, I think when I started writing stories, I didn't even think of it, or when I started writing novels, I didn't think of it specifically as crime fiction. I just thought of the type of story I wanted to tell, and I think it was influenced by my own sort of late childhood, because when I was growing up, we didn't have this fabulous wealth of young adult fiction that we have now. So you kind of went from children's books, you know, young children's books, what was aimed at teenagers was terrible. It was so anachronistic. It was things that were written 30 years before by people who had written them 30 years after being a teenager. And I went straight from Asterix, you know, and kids' books to Ian Fleming and Robert Ludlum at the age of about 12 and Douglas Adams. So to me, the things that inspired and excited me were the humour and irreverence of Douglas Adams and the sort of tension and high stakes Cold War stuff of Robert Ludlum, and then the fabulously over the top scenarios of Ian Fleming. And so by the time I came to write books myself, my idea of what an adult book was, a grown up book, was something that contained all those things. And I wouldn't have said that it was crime fiction because I hadn't really thought about how to categorise it. But it was a combination of all those three.
And then, and you wrote an interesting piece about gaming and the influence that gaming had on you. And I'm wondering if gaming either informs your plots, or you then wrote a game. Do your plots inform gaming?
Yeah, it wasn't so much the plots as just some of the atmosphere and the excitement, the real sort of visceral excitement of when I first started playing online and other first-person shooters in the late 90s. That I found it. It was quite unlike any other experience. It was more frightening than watching any horror movie. If it was something like Doom and or other things, it was just so adrenaline pumping, and so I wanted to take that kind of feeling and put that sort of pace and that sort of sense of action into stories. So that influenced when I wrote One Fine Day in the Middle of the Night, and then more overtly it influenced A Big Boy Did It and Ran Away, because it was a book that was entirely about gaming culture and the rise in the very early days of online gaming culture. But it was the pioneering days when it was, you really needed to know what you were doing to get online and play and stay online and find your teammates and opponents. It wasn't a question of just plugging in your Xbox and away you go. And so it was an exciting time because people were being very creative. They were creating their own characters and maps, and they were hacking the games to change them, and they were coming up with their own slang, and I love that subculture. So I wrote about that in A Big Boy Did It and Ran Away, and then Pandemonium was kind of my love letter to two things: one, first person shooters like Doom, and 80s slasher movies, because it was a book essentially about a bunch of teenagers going off to the wilds and being picked off one by one by demons in this case. But it was a horror story, and a philosophical horror story, because it was also about where our ideas of demons come from. So it was full of gaming references, and it was that book that brought a gaming developer brought me to their attention, and they asked me, having read Pandemonium, would I be interested in working with them to develop an FPS? And that led to Bedlam, which became a kind of parallel project. I can't really say that I wrote a book and then they made a game, or that I was writing a game based on a book, but I came up with a concept, outlined the idea, and once I'd outlined the idea for the game, I realised it would actually work as a novel. So the two things have developed in tandem, although the book took considerably less time to create and to complete than the game has. But the game is almost done. It was showcasing at GDC in San Francisco earlier this month as part of Idea Xbox. So it's out on Xbox One quite soon, and it's out on Steam. It's almost finished, the Steam version. It's on early access just now. It's been great fun seeing how people have responded to it, and my son is constantly amused by the fact that American reviewers in particular keep describing the characters as Irish because the cast are all Scottish, and they're obviously insufficiently familiar with the accent to be able to tell the difference.
The geographically challenged.
I was explaining to my son that maybe this is a legacy of James Doohan in Star Trek, because his attempt at a Scottish accent sounded more Irish than Scottish, so perhaps a whole generation of Americans have thought that an Irish accent is a Scottish accent and vice versa.
Yeah, I wish. one more question. At the end of Dead Girl Walking, Parlobane has a very interesting meeting, and I don't want to introduce any spoilers, but I'm wondering if there's A, going to be another Parlobane mystery, and B, is that meeting going to be part of it or something that launches it?
Kind of. I've actually, today, at like literally 5 minutes before this Skype conversation, finished the first draft of the new book, which does have Parlobane in it. He's not quite as central to this story as to the last one, but he is, I'd say, about a third of the book is from his point of view. It's more of a kind of Hitchcockian suspense thriller about a question of whether a woman has murdered her husband. But at the very end of this, like, again, it takes one stage further, the conversation you've just referred to, because the third in what's going to be three Parlobane stories in a row is going to be the one that starts to really delve into that possible murky world. So it is something I'm planning to explore, but I came up with this idea for this suspense novel and just thought this is, you know, too good to wait. So the things that are alluded to at the end of Dead Girl Walking are going to have to sort of take a back seat for a book, and then I'm going to get tore into them in the book that follows.
So I kind of lied because I did want to ask if there is another Jasmine Sharp and Catherine McLeod novel on the way. I believe there's one in the UK, but is there one in the States?
No, there's been three in the States and in the UK, but there's been a degree of confusion over the fact that there was a different title for
Bread and the Bone instead of Flash Wounds, yes.
Yeah. Another Robertson Davies allusion there.
no, I was going to mention that. Another nod to Robertson Davies. I would show you that I actually have a signed copy of The Lyre of Orpheus, and it's one of my prized possessions.
That would be, yes.
Because he made very few appearances. He was really kind of contemptuous of all of that, which was sort of refreshing. I think he would have been great on Twitter.
Well, I loved there was two instances of his extremely dry wit that I adored. One was when an early interviewer or interviewer was asking him about the fact, she brought up the fact that his first novel wasn't very well received by Canadian critics. And he sort of looked her in the eye and said, yes, and they're all dead now. But my favourite Robertson Davies moment was that when he was a professor at which university in Toronto, that he once set as a final exam question, Eugene O'Neill's Long Day's Journey Into Night is one long snot-ridden whine. Discuss.
Well, I think he captured... One of the things I think he did really, really well was sort of capture the Canadian state of mind, which is so difficult to penetrate. It's such a colossal, you know, it's a colossal inferiority complex, and not necessarily deserved, and yet so self-inflicted.
I remember a Canadian saying to me the Canadian joke about how do you get 50 Canadians out of a swimming pool? You say, please leave the swimming pool.
Excellent. Thank you again, Chris, for joining us. And Dead Girl Walking is out in the States in May, I believe.
That's right, yeah.
And any plans to come over for book tour here?
No, I'm still waiting for some festival somewhere to invite me. And if they ever do, I'll be on the first plane.
And do you plan, next question, I know I keep lying, but the next question, will you be at Bloody Scotland in 2015?
Yes, I will.
Okay, well, I look forward to seeing you there.
Okay, you too. Okay.
Thanks again.
Cheers then. Bye.
Bye.
Next week's guest is Attica Locke, whose third novel, Pleasantville, picks up the story of activist-turned-lawyer Jay Porter, introduced in her debut mystery, Blackwater Rising. Until then, this is Nancy Clare. Thank you for listening to Speaking of Mysteries.